James.
Hey, how's it going, Andy?
Hey, what's up, man? How you
Not
doing?
too much. Doing well. Early for you out there, huh?
Yeah, but going to work, so what else am I going to do, you know? What could be better?
Yeah. What do you do exactly?
I'm a teacher.
Oh, great. Yeah. Where do you live in L.A. exactly?
I live in Hollywood.
Okay.
I don't know if you spend a lot of time here. But
I haven't, no. Yeah, that's great. I'll be out in L.A. for 2 weeks in July, but it's, you know, we're sequestered at USC on the campus, and we work with the L.A. Philharmonic, too, so it's, yeah, we don't, I mean, we get a little bit of evening work, but it's like a big 10-day seminar, so we're, you know, it starts early in the morning, and then they're socializing into the evenings and events and all that stuff. So we get, we probably get like 3-4 evenings to do stuff, but usually it's like group stuff with the participants who are all adults. You know, it's like an adult kind of like a leadership training program. So yeah, I mean, it'll be cool to be out there for a little, you know, extended period of time instead of just like a quick trip in and out. But at the same time, we feel very sequestered. You know, when we do these programs, it's like you're not on vacation at all. So, but yeah, I mean, but we'll definitely get out and, you know, do some hiking and, you know, go to the beach and stuff, probably a little bit here and there. So looking forward to it. Good.
How does that correlate to what you're working on, like musically and composition? How does the leadership skills play a role in what you're doing?
Well, mostly they're totally separate skill sets. I mean, I'm a program manager for a nonprofit that services American orchestras. And that work, I mean, it's really a day job kind of thing. I mean, I like the work that I do. I like the artistic stuff that I do because I run a lot of the artistic programs for conductors and composers and things of that nature. But it doesn't, you know, I see them as two different entities. I mean, writing music is a creative process. So I'm writing an opera right now, and it's collaborative because, you know, we have a person writing the book, writing the libretto. We have, you know, stage director, the producer. So it's collaborative work, but I guess those types of, you know, collaborative relationships should be seen in some of the day job work, but I see them totally separate. They don't touch as far as I'm concerned. I mean, sure, we talk about music on both sides. You know, when you're working with collaborative people, you know, you talk about things that influence you, and we talk about things that are, you know, influencing us on the professional side, things we've read, concerts we've seen. But yeah, they're totally separate in my world. You know?
Well, then we both have kind of something in common in that, you know, you do the day job, and it, you know, it satisfies something inside of you and hopefully, you know, feeds what you do in some way, but your passion and what you really want to be working on is music.
Yeah. I mean, when I first moved to New York, I did temp jobs and, I did working for like one of the big finance companies and then a pharmaceutical company, just doing, you know, like whatever work. And, you know, and I mean, I hate to say, you know, that I'm really different than people, but I didn't have a lot of common with people. You know, a lot of people are really into, you know, the New York sports. They're into the football and they're really, really, really into baseball. And, you know, I mean, it's not really, really my thing. And we didn't have a lot of common ground, but when I moved into the music industry to work, suddenly, you know, you start getting real friends because you all have that common ground, which is classical music or just music in general. And so that became, you know, a really important part of my life.
Yeah, I mean, it must have helped you make some connections, too.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, I mean, your colleagues could be, you know, a musician, too, that you can hire to, you know, do a concert that you're producing. So, and that's, you know, not that, you know, working in the finance, you know, for like a hot months. I mean, there's some really great people there, but they just, you know, they weren't people I had a, you know, whole lot in common with, except going out for drinks after work and talking shit, you know, and that's about it. But.
Well, so let's take it back from New York back to Northern Virginia, or even before that. Where you were born in Rhode Island, is it?
I was. Newport, Rhode Island.
Yeah,
yeah,
that's funny. I was just there last summer.
Oh, were you? Yeah, yeah, it's beautiful there. I mean, it's a, I mean, I'm a little biased since I was born there, but I really like it. Yeah, so my mother is from Rhode Island, and so, I mean, I guess my whole life has had this kind of, like, duality. You know, I was born in New England, but I was raised in Northern Virginia, and, you know, I work in the classical music industry, but I probably look more like I play country and western music. I do classical. So, you know, that whole, like, juxtaposition. And, you know, when I was in, you know, I'd always played in bands. I always played in punk and heavy metal bands. And then at night in my other life, I was, like, doing, you know, degrees in classical guitar and stuff. And then it's like, you know, I'm hanging out with all these, you know, guys that, you know, aren't going to college, but then I'm secretly going to college and no one knew about it, or maybe they did, you know, sometimes. But so, yeah, so that's, you know, I was born in Rhode Island, and, you know, shortly thereafter, you know, the family moved down to Virginia, and my brother was born in Virginia, and my sister was born in Virginia, so.
What brought the family down to North Carolina?
My dad was an officer in the Navy, and he got a job at the Pentagon, so.
How old were you at that time?
Oh, just like one, probably, and even, maybe not even a year.
Oh, okay. You don't even remember the time in Rhode Island.
No.
So, like, you were raised in Northern Virginia, and you guys were in Reston first when you moved there?
I think it was Arlington for the first couple of years, and then my dad took a job at the CIA, and then we moved out to Reston, and. Yeah, I can't remember exactly where we lived. One of the, you know, like one of the townhomes, and then I guess they call it Old Reston now. I'm not 100% sure.
What was like your elementary school and your like neighborhood that you sort of grew up in?
We went to Dogwood Elementary, and
okay.
Then we would have gone, actually I was just down there in February, and we took a drive because my son was kind of want to wake him up, so we drove by South Lakes and Lentz and Hughes, which we both went to as well.
And what were your early music experiences there?
Well, that's a good question, which I don't think about too often. I guess going back all the way, it's, you know, my mom listened to a lot of folk music. She listened to a lot of, you know, like Peter, Paul and Mary, Bob Dylan. She listened to a lot of bluegrass. I remember her listening to, you know, some R&B like Roberta Flack, you know, some of it's, you know, way back when. And then my dad was kind of like the counterpoint to all that. He really liked his classical music, his Beethoven, his Bruckner, and he was really into like Gilbert and Sullivan, and I think, you know, he even did like one of the like productions of like Pirates of Penzance at the Reston Town Center or whatever over there. And, you know, he also liked, you know, some of the pop folk, you know, folk groups like the Kingston Trio and stuff like that. So that, but that was like the real early stuff that, you know, was around the house. And, you know, I mean, I don't know if it's, you know, thinking forward, you know, what did you take back? You know, from all that that upbringing and the music, and I know I like everything. I think is one thing because there's so much music around the house, that, and I gravitated towards classical music as my creative outlet. But I played in band and did all that the whole time. I think one of my favorite memories is I learned how to hate songs real early. So I can remember being in the car. My mom had the radio on that. Band on the Run by Paul McCartney and Wings was on, and I could not stand that song. Turn it off, turn it off.
Band on the Run. Band on the Run.
thought it was called Man on the Run. That was kind of cool, but I really hated it. Like, I had really strong opinions of what I liked from a very, very early age. And I don't know if that's a good thing or a bad thing. I just always think it's funny when I think back on it. And, yeah, I mean, that's kind of a way, I mean, I think the musical environment that we grew up, my parents both sang in the church choir. So that was probably, I personally hated church and did my best to never go when possible. But the music stuck with me because the guy that, his name is John Scalia, he was a really good musician, fantastic ears, really, really great arranger. And I think I learned an awful lot about music just by kind of being part, being there. And a lot of times they had rehearsals at our house, or we would go to church early because they'd be having their little choir rehearsal, like a run through before, church started and stuff. So I got to hear how the songs were broken down and hear them rehearsing sections and stuff. So that was probably really more important than I, probably give credit to. And that's kind of what the early life was like. I didn't really play an instrument early on. Tim did percussion, played drums in school. I always wanted to play cello and I wanted to play piano, but that didn't all work out. I found a guitar in my parents' closet, and I think I was probably not even 10 years old, and I wrote my first song called Chickens in the Yard. I learned two chords from the chord book that was stuffed in the case, and unfortunately, the guitar I learned later was out of tune, so when I tried it out on an in-tune guitar, my song was lost forever. So that was kind of the foundation of the early years. I think I was listening. I mean, it was always kind of mixed up in the things I liked. Like, I think it's at a Memco right there, the corner of Baron Cameron and Resson Avenue, and there was a Home Depot there, but I bought my first two 45s there. I bought, like, Glen Campbell, Rhinestone Cowboy, and Tom Sawyer's by Rush. Those were the two singles I bought. So I've always been interested in different music, on the different sides.
The game and nice guys get washed away like the snow and the rain. There's been a load of compromising on the road to my horizon, but I'm gonna be where the lights are shining on me like a
Yeah, there's your duality.
I
think later it became Bradley's, and that's where I got my first Yamaha keyboard from.
Oh, right. Yeah.
The same.
Yeah, I like that place. Yeah, I want to go in there now that it's Home Depot, too. But, I don't know, that whole corner was always kind of mystical to me. It was kind of, first music, and then it's a good place.
Well, so when did you start playing music with other people?
Well, I guess, right as I started high school, which was like, the big crowning achievement in life when you're young. It's like, oh, God, going to high school. I felt so much pressure to go to high school. And shortly after being there, it was probably in November, my dad sat the family down. I think my sister had just been born. And he sat us down and he said, we're moving to London. So we all picked up and we moved to London in the end of December. And we lived there for a year. And we got really, really into all the British and European music, pop music, rock, all the metal stuff. And it was, that's where like the birth of like really getting excited about playing music came. And, you know, by the time I was like kind of like noodling around on the guitar a little bit, but I hadn't taken lessons really and had no idea what I was doing. And I desperately wanted to learn songs, but I couldn't like really hear it and find my way around. But I really wasn't trying all that much either. I mean, we were really into BMX bikes and going to so many concerts when we lived in London. So, you know, we're kind of more like sponges at the time, you know, just taking in everything. But by the time we get back to the States, into the, you know, the whole explosion of Poison and Rat and all those types of bands, which is very different than you're listening to in London. Then I got a guitar. I worked at, I think, at a pizza place in, where was it, Hunter's Wood Center before they tore all that down. I saved money and I bought myself like an SG knockoff and a crappy amp, and I started learning songs, like, you know, old Venom songs that are really easy, at like two or three chords, and, you know, trying to pick out the guitar solos. But I saw my brothers the other day over email, like desperately wanted to learn Def Leppard for some reason, but it was so hard, I couldn't find it on the guitar. Yeah, anyway, I started taking lessons after that, and then Tim and I and our best friend Pete Kianka, who's he was playing bass, and we put a little garage band together called Militia, and we did that, you know, probably for like a year in high school. I think we did one show. But at the same time, you know, like after school, we were going around, at least I was, you know, going around to friends' houses and jamming and, you know, trading Ozzy Osbourne licks and showing each other tunes we were learning at the time. And I was doing that. I mean, Tim did, you know, all the band stuff. He was real and, you know, he's playing with LDK and then, you know, he joined the Fail and did all that. And, you know, that took off. I was more like a shredder. I was sitting in my room running arpeggios and being stupid and doing that. So I never really played with anybody again until I moved down to Richmond to go to school. And then I did the cover band thing and met some other guys who were writing original music.
And did you move to Richmond at the same time as your brother?
No, I'm 2 years older. So I went down there and, you know, just started doing the college thing undecided. And you know, it was, you know, important to my parents that I went to college, and I hadn't quite figured it out. So I went down there just covering all the general classes before I made a decision or whatever. And yeah, so, you know, they all used to come down. They used to stay with me, and they did their first show down there when they were staying with me. And, you know, I was, you know, again, I was doing the cover band thing, and I was hanging out with this really, really amazing bass player named Brian Metz, who was a better guitar player than me. He was super smart and really talented, and I was super intimidated by him. He probably doesn't even know that. But, we decided to move to Florida and do the heavy metal thing down there and move to Tampa. And then right about that time, Tim and Avail moved to Richmond, and they got picked up by Lookout and all that stuff and had that big career, you know, that big long career there. So, yeah, so they didn't come down with me, but, you know, certainly I think moving down there and coming to visit, you know, was part of the attraction, getting to know the town and, you know, thinking they had a place to be and could set up shop and do their thing.
What made you move down to Florida then?
Now, the metal scene, yeah, we were kind of into the, you know, that whole, like, there was all the guitar here, and it was like Trent Satriani and Tony McAlpine, and we were listening to Queensryche and Dream Theater and bands like Watchtower, that kind of like complex, you know, metal stuff. We'll be right back. So we didn't know what to do. I mean, Richmond had a really small scene, and we wanted to, like, really give it a shot. So we decided to, we went down, you know, for our spring break, we went down to Tampa and checked it out, and we checked out a couple of the clubs, and it was just, you know, off the charts. It was, for us at least, it was amazing, like all these, and then all the bands that were coming out of the Tampa area, like Nasty Savage and Obituary and on, you know, Cannibal Corpse and all that stuff. So, yeah, we just took the plunge. We went down and both applied to school to go to the University of South Florida in Tampa. And my friend Brian, I think even he was doing like psychology or something, but I got myself into music school, which is a big deal. And I'd become real interested in classical guitar when I lived in Richmond. And I was, I got really obsessed with classical guitar, actually. And so I thought that might be an avenue. So, yeah, I went down, I did school, and I played in bands at the same time. So, unfortunately, Brian, I don't think he had a good time down in Florida. He moved back up to Richmond, back home soon thereafter. I stuck it out and then joined the band, a couple bands, and did that for years. And, you know, at the same time, I was going to school and I was working at CD stores and stuff to support myself. So it's pretty good. Pretty good time.
Did any of those bands play big shows or?
Yeah. I mean, I played a band called Buckethead. We didn't know them there at the time, but the guitarist Buckethead hadn't really jumped on anybody's radar. So as soon as it did, we realized we needed to change the name. But no, we had a really good local, like Tampa, St. Pete, Clearwater following. We were getting pretty well known regionally. We used to do all kinds of big shows. We did a lot of weird, these like death metal festivals because we were like musicians and we had chops and all that. So we would get invited to either be the very last band to play, and you get all these metal guys with their long shirts and all the logos and stuff, just in their arms crossed, nodding their heads as we played. It was pretty cool. Yeah, we had a big enough following, and I guess, you know, we were making a big enough impact because the sound of the band wasn't just like a straight metal band. It was influenced by a lot of stuff that I've been listening to. You know, I listen to a lot of, you know, like funk and R&B and the early rap music and a lot of early hip hop and plus all the metal and rock. And I just kind of combined everything plus, you know, a lot of the classical music, some of the stuff I was, you know, from classical guitar and from some of the music I was learning. We're all kind of getting into that music and mixing up. So the sound was really different. It was like really, really heavy, but it was kind of, I guess, audience friendly at the same time. And so we did that, and we did some really big shows. Like I think the club was called like the Ritz or the Masquerade in Ybor City, and then the A&R person for Atlantic Records, Charlton Ford, got in touch, and she was trying to, you know, like, I mean, it was really just kind of like cursory conversations about getting in line to do a demo deal with Atlantic. But a lot of the labels were down in Florida then looking for bands, like Marilyn Manson and the Spooky Kids, you know, were in Fort Lauderdale, and they were up in the, you know, doing the alternate scene, alternate club scenes that we were doing too, and they got picked up by, I guess, Interscope, and then, you know, they went on to have a huge career in Limp Bizkit. There's a band down in Miami, Collapsing Lungs. So a lot of people were getting demo deals, and, you know, unfortunately, you know, a few weeks later, the bass player and the singer quit, so that conversation came to a screeching halt, and it sucked. You know, honestly, it'd been kind of weird to, like, you know, see that through to see what would have happened, but, you know, I mean, what the last conversation I had with her is like, well, the singer kind of defines the sound of the band, and she was totally right. And, you know, I put it back together. We had a new singer and a much better bass player, but the new singer we had wasn't the same as the old one. And, you know, there's no interest after that. I did it for probably another 2 years. And then, you know, the band drama the started up, and I just walked. I was done. And then I just decided to concentrate on, you know, the classical music I had been doing full time.
Do you see a lot of crossover between, like, compositionally that music that you were playing and the classical music?
I see it all as the same. It's just creative work. I don't see, I mean, I would get, you know, I don't think many people would agree with me on the other side of the fence, but I see them as the same process. I mean, the songs that I wrote just playing guitar, I'm using the same skill sets I am to write classical music. They're one and the same to me. Yeah, I really don't see a distinction. I mean, there's a lot of technical work that goes into writing orchestra music and writing for instruments specifically, you know, that you don't play. So, you know, in a way, I have to play, at least in my mind or intellectually, all these other instruments are right for. But, you know, it's no different. You know, if you're sitting at home and you've got a really great riff, but you're imagining, like, how the drums might sound, and if there was a keyboard and what the bass player might be doing. You know, and then you go into band practice and you kind of, like, say, hey, drummer, do this, and hey, bass player, play these notes. And, you know, to me, it was very much the same type of skill. I hope that answers the question, maybe.
Yeah. Did you feel frustrated at any point by the guitar, by, you know, the limitations of writing music on a guitar?
No, not at all. I prefer to write, you know, classical music, if just to use that term loosely, on piano. Because I liked having the really low notes, and, you know, it just helped me visualize better. But no, you know, I mean, the notes are the notes, and I mean, I haven't written anything for, you know, like, classical oriented on the guitar per se. But I'll pick it up and play things sometimes, and I, you know, musical idea is a musical idea, no matter where it comes from. But, you know, I mean, I've written music for classical guitar, and I will, you know, keep the guitar right next to my side to do that. But my preference is to have a piano to do it.
So did you move straight to New York from Florida?
No, I had to continue to go to school. So how does this work? So in Florida, I was doing a degree in classical guitar. And, you know, I was an okay guitar player, but I certainly wasn't going to have a career being a classical guitarist. I mean, the level of performance is astounding, and I wasn't even close to astounding. I was just okay. And so that was a pretty, as I was getting close to, you know, doing the recitals, and I was thinking to myself, what do I do next? You know, teach guitar. Well, I was already teaching at two local guitar stores, and to have a degree in classical guitar, well, that was a bonus, but that wasn't going to be really a career. And I guess right around that time, I started getting a little you know, confused about what the future might look like. What do I do? I'm going to have a little bit of student loans. And this is, you know, one of these kind of like weird situations in life. So I'm walking across campus and I'm headed towards the music department or whatever because I need to register for class. And I bump into a teacher who I had a lot of respect for. And he was telling me, oh, you know, this class you took with me last semester, all the writing exercises, what we had to like emulate the music we were studying because yours were really, really fantastic. And I was like, oh, thanks. I appreciate that. And he said, you should be a composer. I was like, what's that? And so he told me, and he's like, well, you should, you know, maybe become a composition major and study with me. And I was like, well, that sounds really cool. And that was kind of like a huge life moment, really. And if it wasn't bumping into him, I never had thought about it. I didn't even know what a composer was. So, you know, I finished a double major, so I did composition and I did classical guitar, but writing music became my focus. Everything I possibly could in the small music library there. I asked question after question from anybody I could ask about, you know, music. And I was working in CD stores. I was spending my paychecks on stupid European classical CDs, and just so I could hear the music. And that same teacher at the time, you know, was like, well, perhaps you should probably go to grad school to do this. Seriously, I think you're talented enough. And you know, again, that was very flattering, and I didn't have a whole lot of confidence because I'd only been doing it for about a year and a half. But I'd written three small pieces that seemed okay, and so he helped me pick out some of the universities to apply to, and, you know, I did all the applications, and I sent them off, and I got accepted at one of the best composition programs in the country at the time, which was University of Texas at Austin. So I packed up and moved to Austin. And did my master's degree there, and spent an awful lot of money, and that's where I ended up next. And I was there for 3 years, and then again I came to another point where I had to try to figure out what I wanted to do. And you know, as we were talking about earlier, teaching was really just part of who I was, and I saw myself perhaps as a university professor, and I knew I needed to have real teaching experience under my belt. To do that, I also needed to have a doctorate. And so I began looking at, universities to do my doctorate and, you know, sent in the applications. And I was looking for two things, financial stability, because I needed to have everything paid for because I'd taken on so much student debt when I did my master's at UT Austin. And to have real teaching experience. A lot of times if you get accepted to a doctoral program, you get, you know, kind of a graduate assistant teaching experience where you teach kind of really low-level classes. And that's great. It's I was hoping for a little more that would make me really competitive once I got out of school. And so I ended up, I swore I'd never stayed in the state of Florida again, and I ended up getting accepted to Florida State University, basically for a free ride. And with a lot of teaching experience offered to me. So that was really great, and the teaching experience was exactly what I needed. It was pretty high-level stuff, and I got to teach under upper graduate courses and did that. And then I came to New York. So it's a long story.
Wow, I mean, you really had a lot more experience with school. You said you were doing a little undercover college.
Yeah, the undercover was in Florida. Yeah, and then when I you had to do it, you had to do it right. So yeah, I had to do the full doctorate to be competitive. And you know, as life turns out, you know, I mean, you know, I knew there was this imaginary checklist that, you know, as you're going through, you know, academia and the higher ed, people say, well, you need to have this checked off, and you're not going to get a job if you don't have this. You do this, or you'll never be competitive. And I checked everything off, and I felt really, really good by the time I graduated. And there, you know, a lot of people, you know, were giving me a lot of support and making me feel hopeful about the next step. And then, you know, that year I was applying for academic jobs, there just wasn't a whole lot out there. The marketplace had changed a little bit. I'm not sure why. And there was only, probably a half dozen or so jobs that I was qualified for, and I shortlisted, I think, for one. I did one of the big formal in-person interviews at a big state college, and it didn't end up working out. And it was kind of a tough pill to swallow. Some of my colleagues at FSU, some of the professors there are like, well, you know, we could give you a couple courses to teach here for the next year, and you can keep applying, and I'm sure something will happen next year. And I don't know, that didn't feel very good. And also, I didn't have any money, and I would have to have another job on top of all that teaching. And so I wasn't really sure what to do. And again, as these weird things in life happen, there's a very famous composer who I'd become friendly with, who was coming to FSU once a year. Her name's Elsa Willick. I was having lunch with her that summer, and she lived in New York, and she said, well, you should just move to New York for a year and see what happens. And that was, it was a powerful statement and made me incredibly uncomfortable. And I was like, well, what else am I going to do? So I packed up and moved to New York, and completely blind, I didn't know anybody. I had barely money to survive 3 months saved up, and no job. And I just sublet an apartment for a month and gave it a shot. But I never left. So.
And what year is this at that point?
That's 2003. Yeah. So I've been in New York, I guess, 15, 16 years now.
That's funny. A lot of people were leaving New York around that time.
Yeah, absolutely. And for classical music, it's the center of the universe. So it's where everything happens, and which is incredibly intimidating when you're sitting on the outside. You know, coming from a state school, I didn't go to any of the big conservatories, and it's a challenging environment to be in. And I called and emailed every single person I'd ever met that lived in New York or nearby, and try to get together with them for a beer and hang out and just make friends and just even get a job. And it took me about a year to get on my feet, to stabilize and stuff, but made it through, and all's good.
What did you do?
I started off, as I just mentioned earlier, I had some temp jobs. It's hard to have get temp jobs when you seem overeducated. So I had very thoughtful person pulled me aside at a temp agency and said, your resume is a joke, you need a Y on it. So she took all my education off and fudged some of my work experience, and I ended up getting some of those temp jobs that supported me. And then I had, the whole time I was still applying to academic jobs, hoping that something might open up. I was shortlisted again, but no formal interviews. And then at the same, then I'm looking for a job in the classical music industry. And I'm, doing that, and I'm interviewing, and I guess it was probably like 6, 7, 8 months later, I finally ended up at one of the big management companies. And that's where I got my start, and I worked there for about 6 months with this really tough, boss, who's kind of legendary in the industry. And then I moved on to another management company, and I worked there for 4 years. I was kind of like an associate manager type position, but it taught me everything about the industry, and so that's what I've done ever since. So I have that. I mean, I don't work in management now; I work in nonprofit, side of the classical music industry, but I'm still part of, you know, the big machinery of the classical music world, and then I compose music on the side.
Well, I meant how were you doing it artistically? Like, how were you getting involved in the?
So, there's a guy I'd been at a summer festival with, and he had a new music ensemble, which is basically like a rock band. You know, he had his own band, but we call them ensembles here. And, you know, I got to, you know, we reconnected. And I guess, you know, about a year after being there, he called me up one day. His name's Eric Schwartz, and he said, the current, you know, version of this group is, you know, kind of coming to an end. Do you want to come aboard and be part of it? And I was like, sure. So I ended up kind of running the whole show for about 5-6 years and, you know, producing concerts and hiring musicians. And that's really where I started to connect, you know, with like the scene and meet a lot of people and, you know, have them perform my music. And that's how that all worked out. So it's, you know, again, one of those kind of like lucky situations, but it's just, you know, putting yourself out there and meeting people and that opportunity presented itself.
What was the first piece of music that you had performed?
In New York? Oh, I don't know. Probably just, you know, probably something I'd written in school that we put on a concert. I'm not sure. It's probably just a small chamber piece I wrote. I'd have to go back and look through notes and stuff, but yeah, that's an interesting question. I guess for a lot of people, like a New York performance is like a big deal. It's just I happened to live there and was producing the concert, so perhaps it wasn't as a big deal to me at the time. But if I was on the outside looking in, it would have been really, you know, I would have firmly remembered what that was. You learn a lot, you know, this, you know, like every big city, and especially New York City, there's spaces at a premium. So when you're in school and you're, you know, carrying percussion and bass drums and, you know, marimbas and all these weird instruments, well, they're gigantic. And then you go to put a concert in New York and people are like, yeah, that's not going to happen, man. Like, what? It costs you $1,200 to rent that. Oh, yeah, I guess we're not going to do that, you know. And so, I mean, you'd really cut your teeth on, you know, what it's like to, like, produce music and how much it costs. And, you know, it's not five guys and, you know, the band getting together and playing, you know, a house show and then going to a club. I mean, this was, like, you know, pretty formal venues, and some of them have union staff, and, you know, cost $10,000 to put on a show for 50 people. It's really weird work, but, you know, it was satisfying, and it was good.
Well, take me through some of the highlights in terms of, like, some of these shows that you're talking about that you've been able to put on.
This is, you know, years ago before. I mean, now a lot of what I'll talk about is kind of commonplace, and back then it was really pushing boundaries. So most concerts are done, or the mindset is that you do it in a traditional space. You know, you have a stage. People are sitting down, they're watching, and they're engaging that way. And a lot of what we wanted to do was take music out to other spaces to engage with other people. So we did a show at the Knitting Factory in Manhattan, in the basement space down there. And that was pretty cool. It was noisy. And I think we had some like amplification for some of the instruments, and we had set it up as kind of like a mini rock show. And that was pretty cool. And we used to do shows at, you know, like art spaces instead of formal venues, and those were really well attended. And, you know, just some really, you know, off the beaten path places. We did a show at a church once. We actually did a show at a rock club called Pianos on the Lower East Side. That was pretty cool. Again, it was really noisy. You know, and then we did, you know, traditional shows in traditional spaces. So each season we would try to mix it up a little bit. And, you know, we did, you know, stuff where we had video and we had, like, you know, shows where we had, you know, like electronic music on tape playing along with instruments. And, yeah, we tried our hand at everything. We always tried, you know, we tried to find music that was all different. Nothing sounded the same, to give people a varied experience. And we kept our shows at just an hour to make sure they're not too long. And, yeah, we have like beer and wine, and, you know, make little mini parties out of it. We let people drink during the shows, and if possible. And yeah, and it was kind of, and now a lot of that takes place today. So,
what are you, speaking of today, what are you working on like right now? What is
right now? I am doing. I'm writing a new opera for, I guess, and I'm probably not, I don't really consider myself a mainstream classical composer. I mean, I do have that background, and a lot of what I've done lives, you know, like formal orchestra pieces and things of that nature. But right now, last 5-6 years, I've been doing a lot of opera, and it's not traditional. And so the opera we're doing now is going to be done in a barbecue restaurant in Bushwick, Brooklyn. And it's basically opera dinner theater, and it'll be totally immersive. And the stage is where you sit on the floor eating dinner. So it's going to be kind of wild and kind of crazy. And loosely, it's based on the story of Colonel Sanders. And it's kind of hard. It's still like all being developed now, but it's going to be, the director we work with is just amazing. The librettist is amazing. And they're just these really unique kinds of shows. Like, you know, though it hasn't been produced, I mean, I'm pretty confident that, you know, as we did in the last opera we wrote, that the immersive element would start something like we plant the cast in, you know, seated amongst the people watching the show, so you don't actually know who is in the opera. And then so as the music starts, they get introduced, they'll jump to life. And, you know, it creates a little confusion. It's kind of exciting. You know, things like that. It's just, you know, a lot of fast-moving action. You know, we don't shy away from bad language. You know, the audience becomes cast members at times when we interact with them. It's very circus-like. It's kind of modeled on the opera we did before, which was called Smashed, and it's about the life of Carrie Nation and about her, you know, relationship with alcohol and going into bars and smashing them up with rocks and things of that nature.
Like a fucking wasted, like I've had 9 beers.
I'm up to 8 shots. What is this bruise?
I'm like Tona Tara. When did I get this wet? Did I get this freaking tat?
I'm so lost. I'm so totally torn.
I'm so
late,
I'm so
late.
kind of, you know, it's these kind of crazy shows that, but they're based in opera with opera singers, so it's a total unique experience.
And do you think that that kind of, like, connects back to sort of your punk rock roots?
Yeah, I mean, it's a good question. I think, for me, you know, the audience is really important. I mean, you know, when you're in bands, you don't want to, you know, you look out in the audience, you don't want people just standing there. You want them moving. You know, it's like nothing worse than writing a song and working your ass off and everyone's just like, that's great. You know, it's like you want everyone dancing and jumping around and, you know, whatever they're going to do. And I feel very much the same way with the music I write now. And, you know, a lot of people would disagree with me about that. But, yeah, I mean, I think, you know, going all the way back and forth, it's all one giant piece that's connected.
What is your absolute, like, dream project? Do you have
something? I would love to write a main stage opera, which means, you know, like, fully produced on an opera stage. You know, the big grand opera. I would love to do that. You know, have a cast of 15 singers and a choir and a full orchestra. That'd be pretty amazing.
Well, it sounds like you're on your way, and you know the right people to eventually make that happen.
Yeah, I mean, I know a lot of people, but to make it happen is a totally different. Yeah, again, a lot of it's just hard work, being at the right place in the right time. A lot of success has to be with what you do and how it's aligned with the tastemakers of the industry. So you can be behind the curve, you can be ahead of the curve, but if you're not, like, right in the pocket, then you're an outsider. So, I mean, I've seen, you know, like, a lot of the work that we used to do with that new music ensemble by Rand Forecast Music was a little ahead of the time, and now it's kind of in the pocket. And, I mean, I would hate to, you know, sometimes you're just a little late. I think those are the copycats that come. Yeah, just like the band world. You know, you get Metallica, and then you get every band that wants to be Metallica. But Metallica had, you know, a small following because they were unique early on, and then they kind of became the taste, and then you get the followers. So, pretty similar.
Yeah, and then you get all the blowback from the original.
Mm-hmm. And then you get the reunion tour.
So you said you're actually coming back to or through Virginia this summer.
Yeah. Well, I'll just, I'll be in L.A. for that 2 weeks, I think. And then, I'll have to take a red-eye home and then get up. And no, I haven't slept yet, that's right. So then I get in the car and I drive all the way down to Richmond for a show that day. So that would be cool. And then, you know, probably spend a little time down there.
Are you looking forward to being back in Virginia?
Yeah. I mean, I don't go back too often. I mean, I try to a couple times a year, but usually the trips are really quick. And usually I'll spend, you know, like a day in Reston and then a day down in Richmond. My brother and sister live down there, so we'll do that. And both my parents, they live up in Reston, so.
They're still in Reston, huh?
Yeah. So, yeah, when we go back, I mean, it's, you know, it's weird. Usually we'll just come in, you know, that afternoon and hang out with them and get up the next morning and drive down to Richmond. And, occasionally we'll stop back on the way home. If not, we'll just drive all the way back home. But, I feel really disconnected from Virginia. I feel from Reston, for sure, but I feel probably more connected to Richmond because I spend much more time down there than I do in Reston.
Well, it's pretty amazing, you know, what you have been able to do musically, you know, from starting in Reston and your family, from having that, you know, that environment that music was around so much and was such an important part of the lives, it seems like, of your family. They must be just so happy and thrilled.
Yeah. I mean, I've got no complaints at all. I mean, yeah, my brother is a fantastically successful and talented musician. I mean, it's just absolutely amazing. Yeah, my sister is a great violinist, and she has a big, you know, Suzuki studio in Richmond, and all three of us are connected to music for our livelihoods, and that's pretty amazing. And you know, from my mom played a little guitar, my dad did a little singing. They both sang in the choir, and you know, I don't know. It's something that's all in our DNA that we have to do music, and that's pretty cool.